there was no moon that autumn night, and scarcely a star could be seen in the thick black sky. The snow had already come. It had coated the jagged mountain peaks with an icy crust, and it lay crisp and fresh in the valleys. The air was still and silent. It carried no singing from the monastery, no pealing of bells, no laughter from the village. It carried nothing but a deathly hush across the Ammer Valley. Suddenly there were footsteps, the shuffling of boots down a slope, a rustling in the trees, then the thud of the snow falling from the branches. A dark figure had appeared on the winding path and was moving stealthily from tree to tree, groping in the shadows. As the man crept around the corner of the hillside, something stopped him abruptly. There, only yards away, he could see fires burning brightly around the village boundaries. Lively flashes of light illuminated the whole landscape, while Oberammergau slept peacefully behind a curtain of flames. The man did not stand there for long. With a sharp intake of breath, he continued down the slope and paused behind a fir tree only a few feet from the ring of fire. Then voices came to him, voices that sang and jeered at one another. Three men lay beside one of the fires. A large stein of beer passed between them. Guards. The man peered at them thoughtfully from his hiding place. Then his eyes were drawn to a neighboring fire. It spat and hissed at him. Its blue and red sparks leapt at him. Its black smoke stung his eyes. But its keeper was busy with his friends. Caspar Schisler wasted no time. His nimble body stalked round the side of the tree and shot through the boundary line unseen and unheard. He crept through the deserted streets without a backward glance, turned down a narrow lane, and came to a small white house with a wooden door. He hesitated for a second, then knocked.
"Open the door! Open the door! Make haste, I beg you. Open the door!"
"Can a woman have no peace? Who is there? And what time of night do you call this? Stop that noise, you'll wake the whole street. Who is it?"
"It's your husband. It's me. Let me in or I'll freeze to death. Open the door."
"Oh, Caspar. However did you get here? There are guards all around the village. There are fires. The village has been closed by the council. You're not allowed in. Oh, do you know what you've done? Oh, my dear. My dear. I thought we would never see each other again. I've been praying for you to come home. I have prayed and prayed."
Caspar Schisler took his wife in his arms and comforted her. For them, this was a great reunion. She had been busy preparing food for the annual Kirchweih festival, which marked the anniversary of the consecration of the village church. It was always the cause of great celebration. But this year, her husband was not to be with his family. In fact, she had feared that they may never see him again.
"Now, now. This is no time for tears. It's time for rejoicing. It's the Kirchweih. Of course I had to come home to you all. I've never been away at Kirchweih."
"Oh, yes. Yes, it's wonderful. Now, my dear, you must be so hungry. Come and have some food. Everything's ready for the feast. All your favorites."
"No. No. I'm sorry. I couldn't eat a thing just now. I'm so tired. I really must rest. Don't worry, I shall eat all your delicious food tomorrow. All I need is sleep. I must go to bed."
Daybreak came. In this small and industrious community, great preparations were in progress for the 3 days of Kirchweih festivities. Music was drifting through the streets, accompanied by the excited cries of children. This year, however, there would be none of the usual travelling sideshows and actors, nor the colourful processions from nearby villages. and there would be no visiting showground people, who had always been received with delight. But there would be rejoicing nonetheless. Women worked hard at their stoves, preparing cakes from eggs and honey with homegrown plums, dumplings with egg and marrow, pickled cabbages, and sausages with potatoes and buttermilk. The men went out hunting hares or roebuck, and some would even return proudly flaunting a partridge or woodcock to grace their family table. Others prepared for the entertainments, the children's games, and the all-night dancing. Most important to every villager would be the mass in the village church. An atmosphere of merriment reigned in Oberammergau, as more and more of the homemade beer was consumed. For a while at least, they could forget their troubles and those of the surrounding countryside. But down a narrow lane, in a small house with a wooden door, troubles were not forgotten. Caspar Schisler did not get up to enjoy his wife's cooking, or to join in the preparations for the day ahead. His children did not play outside with their friends. They did not take part in the singing or the chain dance. They had not been to mass or seen the procession to the market square. For Caspar Schisler lay in a fever. His lips were parched, his throat burned, and his body ached. As she mopped his brow, his wife wept. A few hours before, she had felt such happiness and relief. But now she shook with fear and dread at what may happen. And by the third day of the festivities, Caspar Schisler was dead.
Caspar Schisler, the labourer, came home in secret and has died?
He just slipped past the guards, they say. They're questioning the men on duty.
But how did he die? You don't suppose...
Strained heart, according to his wife.
Too much beer, if you ask me.
Helga Brown in the bakery told me Schisler's brother's very ill.
Then Helga Brown is a scaremonger.
And his children haven't left the house for days.
Then I expect they...
Citizens of Oberammergau, please be silent for an announcement from the Council of Elders. Let the worthy councillor speak.
My fellow townspeople, it is with deep regret that the council informs you of the death of a farm labourer from this village by the name of Caspar Schisler. It grieves us further to notify you that his wife and eldest son are both dangerously ill. We had taken every precaution to avoid this. We had scoured floors and washed clothes with the utmost care. We had burned all refuse and eliminated every trace of vermin. And as you know, we had even closed our village to all visitors, including those townsfolk who had journeyed away from home. But it is now with great sorrow that I must tell you we have not escaped. The Black Death is upon us. The great plague has come to Oberammergau.
Oberammergau, an enchanting Bavarian village, nestles peacefully in the heart of the Ammer Valley. The River Ammer flows through on its way to the Ammersee in the north, while the majestic Alps rise up on each side, some mountain peaks reaching over 6,000 feet. On a clear day, Germany's highest mountain, the Zugspitz, can be seen from the village. Every season of the year, the scenery is breathtaking, and Oberammergau itself is as charming as a fairy tale with its quaint parish church, cobbled lanes, and wooden-roofed houses. Beautiful hand-painted murals adorn the sides of buildings, while in summertime, window boxes provide a glorious array of colourful flowers throughout the little town. The history of Oberammergau is as enchanting as the village itself, so much so that the story of its people has become a legend. For centuries, Oberammergau lay hidden in the undiscovered Ammer Valley. The Romans built a road through the mountains in order to supply their forces in the north. And Oberammergau found itself playing host to Roman soldiers for some years. But with the decline of the Roman Empire, the valley lost any importance until the 9th century, when it came under the domination of a powerful European family, the Guelphs. For hundreds of years, the valley changed hands from family to family until the 14th century, when Ludwig, Duke of Bavaria, became its dominating figure. It was his son, another Ludwig, elected Emperor of Bavaria in 1314, who founded the Ettal Monastery, only 2 miles from Oberammergau. This monastery, peopled with 20 Benedictine monks and built with the help of the Oberammergau villagers, was to play an important role in the future development of the village. For Oberammergau came under the protection of the monastery, and its people began to enjoy certain unusual hereditary rights granted to them by the emperor. They were freed from serfdom and permitted to do as they wished with their homes and to cultivate their own land. Gradually, the reputation of the monastery spread, and merchants began to make a pilgrimage to Ettal. The Oberammergau villagers, being of an industrious and enterprising nature, were quick to capitalize on this and were granted the sole rights to provide teams of horses to pull merchants' coaches up the hill to the monastery. Repair shops, eating houses and warehouses for storage soon sprang up around the village to cope with the growing demand for such services, and the people proved most hospitable to their visitors. This newfound tourist industry was much welcomed by the village, since farming was of little account, the soil of the valley being poor and difficult to cultivate. By the time the Roman road was reopened, the Ettal Monastery had become quite famous, and more travellers were encouraged to make the journey to Oberammergau. The villagers elected a council of elders who enforced strict trading regulations and codes of conduct on visiting merchants and local people alike. And it was at this point that the well-established art of wood carving began to emerge as a viable industry in this small but expanding community. Some believe that the villagers took to this craft to ease the boredom of the long, cold winters. But whatever its origin, it still plays an important role in the life of Oberammergau today. The villagers had always carved their own furniture and kitchen utensils from the pine and fir trees covering the mountain slopes. But they now began to make religious souvenirs from the wealth of timber surrounding them. Gradually, pilgrims and merchants bought these carved mementos in large quantities to sell throughout Germany and Italy. In fact, the carven images of Oberammergau became renowned throughout Europe, and wood carving was established as the major source of livelihood in the village, bringing considerable prosperity to the people.
Sadly, Oberammergau's boom period was short-lived. Religious riots were dividing the country by the middle of the 16th century, and an upsurge of crime, vandalism, and devastation followed. Germany was beset with problems, and Oberammergau too was feeling the effect of its country's unrest. Before long, merchants refused to risk the journey through the mountains for fear of being set upon by escaped prisoners and convicts, desperate for food and money. So the flow of trade through the Ammer Valley came to a halt. And by 1618, Germany stood on the verge of the 30 Years' War, which was to bring with it further destruction, poverty, crime, and worst of all, rampant disease. The Great Plague of 1632 caused many thousands of refugees to flee across Europe, leaving their homes to be burned and their crops destroyed. Many, ravaged by hunger and fear, died on their route, and rotting corpses lay in streams and fields throughout the continent. The Black Death was uncontrollable, as it swept through Germany with the most devastating and tragic effects. Although the people of Oberammergau were well aware of the effect the disease was having on their fellow countrymen, they themselves remained free of the plague for some months. They took measures to preserve their isolation and did not venture out of the valley. The moment the news reached Oberammergau, that the fatal illness had spread to a small hamlet only a few miles away. The council ordered the village to be closed immediately, in a last, desperate attempt to keep the plague out. When this proclamation was issued, it was firmly stated that no one would be allowed to enter the village under any circumstances, and that any Oberammergau villagers who happened to be outside the village at that moment were to remain in exile. All but one of them did. Caspar Schisler returned to Oberammergau and brought with him the terrible disease which soon spread through the community until there seemed to be no hope of halting its progress.
One tragedy followed another. Entire families perished. Every day more graves were dug. Every hour more prayers were offered. Until, in the summer of 1633, the council elders called the pitiful survivors of the village together and turned their thoughts to God, in the hope of finding some divine explanation for this terrible stroke of fate.
My fellow villagers, we have all suffered greatly. Look at us all. We are sick and dying, and live in constant dread of what the next day will bring. But why? What have we done?
The wise old counselor gazed at the blank, pale faces before him. A sea of hollow, glassy eyes stared back. Some wept, but most could not find the strength. No one spoke. Then the parish priest rose to his feet and addressed the ragged and tormented crowd.
In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth, and he looked down upon the earth and saw that it was good. Then God created man, and he gave to man the powers of good and of evil. And God so loved his people that he gave his only Son, Jesus Christ, so that all men could be saved. But today it would seem that there is little goodness and little faith left. And we are now racked by a terrible sickness, a fatal sickness. Will God spare anyone? Will he spare the faithful who repent of their sins? We must show that we still have our faith, that we believe and trust in him. I ask now that every one of us, however sick, however old, make their way at once to our church, where we will pledge our faith to God and pray for his forgiveness and for our salvation.
There was a faint murmur in the crowd as the people looked up at the priest with incredulous faces. Then slowly, one by one, they began to move, to walk down the narrow cobbled lanes towards the parish church. The healthy held hands with the sick, the young supported the old, and the pathetic procession entered the church, each taking their place in the pews. It was at this moment that the people of Oberammergau made their famous vow to God.
Dear Lord, we have sinned. We pray for your forgiveness. We ask, too, that you will deliver us from this dreadful sickness. We pledge our undying faith in you, and we make a solemn vow. The people of Oberammergau hereby promise that they shall, once in every 10 years, perform a play of Christ's passion, his crucifixion and resurrection. This play shall be performed here until the end of time, in gratitude for Jesus Christ, your only Son, whose life was given for us. And this is our sincere and humble promise. Amen.
Black Death continued to claim thousands of lives throughout Europe, But from that day forth, in the little village in the Amma Valley, the sick began to recover, and no further lives were claimed by the plague. The Oberammergau Passion Play was born.
In the light of this miracle, it is not surprising that for over 350 years, the Oberammergau villagers have done their utmost to fulfill their promise to God, despite persistent wars which have brought strife and poverty to the community. Though some seasons were postponed, and on some occasions only a few performances took place, the village has succeeded in staging its production with conscientious regularity. Sitting today in the enormous auditorium of the Passion Theatre, among some 5,000 spectators from all over the world, it is virtually impossible to imagine the humble origin of this unique and spectacular event. The two main streets of Jerusalem stretch before you on the stage. Steps lead up to the house of Caiaphas, the high priest of the temple, on the right, and on the left stands the house of Pontius Pilate, the governor. The stage itself is open air, though the auditorium is sheltered. And the magnificent Bavarian Alps provide a stunning backcloth to the set, adding to the grandeur of the occasion.
More than 1,000 players are involved in the play, including some 200 children. The scenery must be rebuilt and painted for each season, and costumes and props revised and repaired. Many of these are very ancient and made from expensive materials from the Far East. The mantle worn by Joseph of Egypt was actually bought in Tehran and is now extremely valuable. The cross used for the crucifixion has also been in use for many years, and it is extraordinarily heavy. A lighter cross weighing 85 pounds is actually carried to Golgotha. Lighting and sound technicians are engaged along with a large number of staff to administrate the entire undertaking. It is a mammoth task for the people of Oberammergau, and virtually every member of the village is involved in one way or another.
As many as 90 performances of the play may be staged, each one lasting all day, with only a break for lunch. The season runs from May to September. But in spite of worldwide publicity and acclaim, the people of Oberammergau still regard the Passion Play as an intensely personal affair. In fact, it's viewed by many as more of a religious service than a theatrical event. There are regulations designed to protect the play from exploitation and abuse, and to preserve its sanctity. No personal publicity is allowed to any individual member of the cast. No photographs are to be taken during a performance, and no wigs, false beards, or makeup are permitted. The men taking part grow their hair and beards in biblical style, especially for the occasion. No married women are allowed to perform in the play, so many a wedding is postponed until a season is over, if a would-be bride is anxious to play a part. No professional actors are engaged, but all those performing in the play must have lived in the village for at least 20 years. And what's more, the play is only expected to interfere with normal occupations when actually in performance. During the many months of rehearsal prior to each season, each man and woman is required to continue with his or her normal role in the community.
The organization of such an event seems utterly daunting to the visitor. But the Oberammergau villagers have made an art of it. A committee of 24 are largely responsible for organizing the event. And this committee is elected for every season. Competition for the leading roles is fierce. Training plays, which are staged during the interim years by hopeful contenders, provide an opportunity for the committee to witness the talent available. And election day, when the cast is announced, begins with a service in the parish church. The names of the successful candidates are posted on a notice board in the square outside the theater. The village is alive with excitement on this particular day. And there are many elated faces, though naturally enough, There are also a few disappointments.
The most famous and respected of all the actors to have played Christ is Anton Lang, whose family have been involved in the play for many decades. In fact, on the shops around Oberammergau, you will see the names of a number of families who have had strong ties with the Passion Play throughout its history. Indeed, many villages today have at least one ancestor who was present at the church in 1633 when the vow was taken. But in 1634, when the vow was first honoured, the play was a humble though reverent occasion, staged in the village church and attended only by the villagers. However, by 1664, there was a growing interest in the event, and it was decided to perform the play in the churchyard due to a greater demand for seats. By 1820, people were travelling not only from all over Germany, but from other parts of Europe to see the Passion Play. In 1871, the Prince of Wales, later King Edward VII, and Princess Alexandra, travelled to Oberammergau incognito to witness a performance. And by this time, the venue had moved to what came to be known as Passion Meadow, on which site stands the theatre of today. A construction was built in 1890 with a proper stage and auditorium, but the present building wasn't erected until 1930, and its capacity has been increased over the years.
The content of the play has undergone considerable change. Originally, there was no music, and the text used was thought to have been written by monks and not specifically for the people of Oberammergau. This version was performed for over 100 years until a new edition was written, a powerful drama full of hellfire and damnation. When a ban was placed on all religious drama, the play was again rewritten in the hope that it might receive a more favourable response from the authorities. This version was not altogether successful, and in 1810, Ottmar Weiss rewrote it, adhering strictly to the biblical story and creating a straightforward dramatic representation of events. It was then that the music was added, composed by Rochus Dedler, a native of Oberammergau, and from this time forth the play began to receive considerable attention from visiting Europeans, and its popularity increased dramatically. The version currently being performed is a new edition of both the text and the music.
So, the story of the Passion Play of Oberammergau is the story of the village itself. So closely are the lives of the people interwoven with a solemn vow made to God centuries ago. Times have changed. The village has changed, as too has the play itself and the method of production. But nonetheless, the play continues to be a manifestation of the faith of the people, a faith which goes back over 350 years. And it is this spiritual element which is of the greatest importance to Oberammergau. It is refreshing to find a small corner of today's fast modern world still steadfastly loyal to its forebears. The experience of witnessing this remarkable dramatic performance in what was once a tiny, insignificant hamlet of Bavaria is an experience of a lifetime.
Yet he has brought to us all forgiveness and salvation from the cross. Let us join in prayer as the time nears for the payment of our debt, of our most sacred vow to the eternal God.
Jesus of Nazareth was among the many pilgrims journeying along the hot, dusty roads to Jerusalem for the feast of the Passover. As he and his 12 disciples entered the city, the crowds who had gathered along the route greeted him with cheers and cries of joy. Jesus made his way directly to the temple, and as he entered its doors, was horrified to see a noisy rabble of tradesmen, money changers and shoppers busy exchanging their wares and making money. But the place fell silent as he spoke.
What is this before me? Do I look upon the house of God or a marketplace? Shall those who come from afar wishing to worship God pray amongst this mob? priests, protectors of this sanctuary, how can you look upon this abomination and do nothing? Get out, I command you. Take your possessions and flee this holy place at once.
Who is this man? How is it you disrupt these proceedings? Do you try to ban what the high priest permits? All that you see before you is for sacrifice to God. Are we to offer no more sacrifices?
There is room enough for your dealings beyond the temple. My house, says the Lord, shall be called the house of prayer for all people. You have turned it into a den of thieves. Take out your goods from here.
The tradesmen and the priests were angered by this, and although they left the temple, they conspired together as how best to treat this new-found prophet, whose popularity in Jerusalem was growing rapidly. Caiaphas, the high priest of the temple, called a meeting of priests and scribes, and they expressed their worries concerning Jesus' teachings and discussed ways of discrediting him. After much deliberation, it was decided Jesus should be seized. One of those at the meeting by the name of Dathan promised to approach one of the disciples who was known to him in the hope of discovering the whereabouts of Jesus, who was in Bethany at the house of Simon the leper. Also present at Simon's house were Jesus' friends Martha, Lazarus, and Mary Magdalene, together with his disciples. It was during supper that Mary Magdalene anointed Jesus' feet with a precious and expensive oil. Judas, one of the disciples, knowing how poor they all were, was alarmed by such extravagance.
We could have sold the oil and given the money to the poor. But now it is lost to us as well as to them.
But Jesus himself took Mary's part.
Why criticize an act committed out of love and gratitude? The poor will always be here for you to tend to, but you will not always have me. Let her be. She has done the right thing. She came to anoint my body for burial.
Then Jesus took leave of his friends and asked his disciples to follow him. Mary Magdalene tried her best to persuade him not to go, saying that she had a feeling of doom. But Jesus insisted it was God's will, and that he would never return to the quiet little town of Bethany. He then said farewell to his mother and set off for Jerusalem. When they arrived in the city, he led his followers to the temple, telling them that it would be the last time he could pray there. Judas was beginning to have grave doubts about the whole situation.
Am I to go with him? I'm reluctant to do so. Once we believed his great deeds would lead to the restoration of the kingdom of Israel. Yet now he talks only of partings and death. It is clear now. Far from sharing in his glorious kingdom, as we were led to believe, the true prospect is a life of perpetual poverty and misery, persecution and imprisonment. Better to part from him whilst there is still time. I shall have to find a new living to support myself. I had hoped to be part of his kingdom of glory, but it does not come. Only wretchedness. Who would want to share that with him? Not I. Not I.
Before the godly prophet goes to his suffering, he offers himself to those who are his, so their souls may be nourished on their earthly pilgrimage. Preparing to sacrifice himself, he arranges a symbolic feast, which through the centuries, till the end of time, shall proclaim his love to all men. Once, long before, through a miracle of the Lord, the children of Israel were blessed with manna in the desert. But from Jesus a greater feast is offered. From the mysteries of body and blood, forgiveness and joy flow to us.
Jesus sat down to his Last Supper with his disciples in the upstairs room of Mark's house in Jerusalem. It was then that he humbly washed the feet of each and every disciple, warning them once more that he was shortly to die. Then he took some bread, broke it, held it up, and said,
"Take this and eat. This is my body which is given for you. Do this in remembrance of me."
Then he took a cup of wine and said,
"Take this and drink, all of you. For this is the cup of the new covenant in my blood, which is shed for you and many others for the forgiveness of sins. Each time you do this, do it in remembrance of me. As my disciples dwell in me, so will I dwell in you. As the Father has loved me, so I have loved you. Take heed of my commands, and my love will stay with you. But he who will betray me sits with me at table."
"What? A traitor? Here among us? Can it be possible?"
"Truly, one of you will betray me."
"Lord, is it I?"
"Is it I, Master?"
"Lord, who is it?"
"It is the man to whom I give this piece of bread after I have dipped it in the dish. The Son of Man is following the path laid out for him in the scriptures. But alas for him who betrays the Son of Man. It would be better for him to have never been born."
Jesus took a piece of bread, dipped it in the dish, then handed it to Judas.
"Do quickly what you have to do."
Judas left the room, and silence fell on the assembled disciples. They waited nervously for Jesus to speak, and perhaps offer some further explanation of this extraordinary behavior.
"Now the Son of God is glorified, and in him God is glorified. I am with you a while longer, and although you will look for me, where I am going, you cannot come."
Simon Peter, in particular, was troubled by these words and begged Jesus to let him follow him wherever he went. Jesus shook his head gravely and made a terrible prophecy. He told Peter that on that very night, before the cock crowed twice, he would disown his master three times. Peter was horrified by this news and looked at Jesus in disbelief, firmly denying the accusation. But Jesus closed the subject.
"My children, why are you so despondent? And why do you look at me with such troubled eyes? Let your uneasy hearts be at peace. Trust in God always, and trust in me. In my Father's house there are many dwelling places, and I am going there to prepare a place for you. I will then return and receive you. Where I am, so will you be. I will not abandon you. I will return. I offer you a parting gift of peace. My own peace, such as the world cannot provide. But this is my command. Love one another as I have loved you."
So at the Last Supper, with a heavy heart, Judas took the bread, and the devil entered his soul. "What you have to do," said the Lord, "Judas, do it quickly." And he fled from the supper room to the high council and sold his master. The most dreadful of deeds is quickly done.
Night had fallen as Judas left Jerusalem for the Mount of Olives, followed closely by an escort of guards, Pharisees, and priests. On the hillside, Jesus was again talking with his disciples.
I tell you exactly how it will happen. You will weep and mourn, but the world will be glad. For though your grief will be deep, the pain will turn to joy, for I shall return. Then indeed your hearts will be full of gladness, joy that no one can diminish. I am of the Father and have entered this world. Now I shall leave the world and return to the Father. My heart weighs heavily with grief. Stay awake with me here. But first I will walk on a little and receive sustenance from the Father. This hour of darkness shall pass. But yet, it is for this I came into the world. Father, my Father, if it is possible, as all things are possible for you, may this cup pass me by. Yet not as I will, but as you will. Simon, are you asleep?
Master? I am here.
Could you not keep awake 1 hour with me?
Forgive me, Lord. I was overcome with tiredness, but now I shall surely stay awake with you.
God's judgment is a heavy burden weighing upon me. The sins of mankind oppress me. Oh, the fearful burden, the bitterness of this cup. My Father, if you cannot allow this hour to pass me by, then let your will be done. Father, hear your son.
What troubles you, Master?
The hour has come. The Son of Man is delivered into the hands of the sinners. Arise, and we shall go. For my betrayer approaches.
Hail, Master!
Brother, why have you come here? Do you betray me with a kiss? You, guards, who are you looking for?
Jesus of Nazareth!
I am he.
Go, seize him!
Jesus' wrists were bound together, and his disciples scurried off into the darkness. Peter had raised his sword against one of the attackers, but Jesus had reprimanded him for doing so. Peter had then fled along with the others. So Jesus was led to the high priest, who was anxiously awaiting his arrival. Annas, gloating over the success of his venture, commanded that Jesus stand trial before the assembly. So the soldiers took him through the streets to Caiaphas. The procession was accompanied by a small crowd who had been hired to jeer at Jesus. But since it was only early morning, they attracted little interest from the other citizens. Peter and John, however, managed to mingle with the crowd, and Peter even succeeded in slipping into the council chamber with those who were to be present at the trial. One by one, the accusations were made. Jesus listened in silence.
So it is you who intended to cause the downfall of our religion and the law of Moses. You are charged with inciting the people to disobey their laws, vilifying the teachings of our forebears, violating the divine commandment to keep the Sabbath holy, and even in indulging in blasphemous words and deeds. Before you stand honorable men who bear witness to the truth of these charges. Hear their testimony, and then defend yourself, if you can. It is said that you boast
divine powers, and that you can perform miracles. A serious accusation which is lawfully proven. Deny it if you can. But it seems that you think your silence can save you.
If you are the Messiah, tell us.
If I tell you I am the Messiah, you will not believe me. If I ask you a question, you will not answer it. Whatever I say, you will not release me.
Take heed, Jesus of Nazareth. I repudiate you by the living God. So tell us, are you the Messiah, the Son of God, who is praised on high?
Yes, I am. But from now on you will see the Son of God sitting at the right hand of God and appearing from heaven.
He has blasphemed God. Do we need more witnesses? We have all heard the blasphemy. What is your verdict?
Jesus must die.
There was a great roar of agreement in the council chamber. Judas heard the noise from outside in the street, and he forced his way into the building, shouting,
I implore you not to do this deed. You have turned me into a traitor with your accursed pieces of silver.
But the offer came from you, and you agreed the price.
I have had enough. Release this innocent man.
Control yourself, Judas.
I demand you release this innocent man. My hands shall be clean of his blood.
Your master must die. You have delivered him to his death.
Then, devils from the depths of hell, destroy me too. Tear me to pieces. Take back your accursed blood money. Let my soul be doomed, and my body burst asunder, and you shall all perish with me.
Judas was removed from the building and stumbled out into the street. Then he staggered towards a nearby field, where he found a rope, and full of remorse and anguish, he hanged himself. The assembly proposed to take their sentence on Jesus to Pontius Pilate as quickly as they could, since they were a little worried that the disciples would themselves appeal to Pilate. Being a Gentile, it was possible that Pilate would sympathize with the false prophet and ignore the decision of a Jewish court. So a deputation to Pilate was sent immediately, and the request was lodged through Pilate's servant Quintus. Outside, while the debate was in progress, a large crowd had gathered and were awaiting news. It was then that Peter was singled out as having been seen with Jesus, and just as Jesus had prophesied, the disciple denied ever having known his master. Jesus was taken before Pontius Pilate, who questioned him closely, and yet not without sympathy. Pilate's wife begged him to have no more to do with the matter, as she had dreamt that Jesus was a good man, and that no good would come of any interference with his affairs. Pilate was most reluctant to pass sentence, and was very relieved indeed when he heard that Jesus was a Galilean. King Herod was responsible for all the people from the Nazareth district, so it was surely Herod who should pass judgment in this case. Delighted at having absolved himself from this responsibility, Pilate sent Jesus on to Herod.
I have heard that you can see into the depths of men's hearts and perform deeds which go beyond the bounds of nature. Well now, give me evidence of these miracles, It is said that you once turned water into wine at a wedding ceremony. So do this now. Or make this room grow dark. I can still see.
He knows nothing and does nothing. He is an ordinary man who has been affected by the applause of the people. Release him. But let him wear this mantle, so he may play his part as the king of fools. Show him to the people, so that they can enjoy him to the full. I believe he is a fool, and incapable of the deeds of which you accuse him. Let Pilate deal with him, as he sees fit.
When Jesus returned to Pontius Pilate, he was flogged before a large, hostile crowd. They all cried in unison, "Crucify him! Crucify him!" Thus was voiced the mood of the people, who had by now all been swayed by the priests into believing Jesus to be guilty. So Pilate now had no alternative but to give the death sentence.
The sentence of death wrung from Pilate is passed. Jesus, burdened with the weight of his cross, staggers to his crucifixion. Once Isaac carried wood upon his own shoulders to the mountain top, where he, himself, by the will of God, was to be sacrificed. Jesus also bears willingly the burden of the cross on which he will sacrifice his holy body. And soon the tree will become a source of blessing, the tree of life.
Carrying a heavy wooden cross, Jesus was led to Golgotha, along with two thieves, to meet his death. The crowd shouted and jeered as he made his way through them, urged on by the soldiers. He stumbled beneath the weight of the cross, and caught a glimpse of Mary, his mother, among the people.
It is my son! Oh God, it is he! My Jesus! He is being led to death like a criminal amongst criminals. Oh, what sorrow can be greater than mine?
One of the guards, seeing that Jesus was suffering and on the verge of collapse, ordered a spectator to take the cross for him, for fear that he should die too soon. Simon the Cyrenian carried the cross on his strong shoulders to Golgotha. The three crosses were laid on the ground, and the three men commanded to lie upon them. They were then stripped, and had long nails driven through their hands and feet. The crosses were then lifted up, and the foot of each one was set in the ground. Above Jesus' head was a sign which read, "Jesus of Nazareth, King of the Jews."
"Come down from the cross, O King of Israel, so that we may see and believe it."
"You wanted to destroy God's temple and to rebuild it in 3 days. So now, save yourself."
"He helped others, yet he's unable to help himself."
"If he has so much faith in God, let God save him now."
"Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do."
"Do you hear? If you are God's anointed, save yourself and us too."
"We suffer justly, for we receive the punishment which we deserve for our crimes. But this man has done no evil. Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom."
"Truly I tell you, today we shall be together in paradise."
"Aha! Listen to that! He thinks he's the Lord of paradise."
"I am thirsty."
"He's thirsty. He wants a drink."
"He shall have it. Drink. Here, drink."
My God, why have you forsaken me?"
"Listen, he is calling on God."
"Will God take him down?"
"It is done. Father, into your hands I commend my spirit."
"What? What is happening? The earth is shuddering!
This was surely a good man. His calm in the most terrific torment. His great dignity. His call to heaven before his death. Truly this is the Son of God.
It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday, 7th of April, A.D. 30. A soldier placed a ladder against the cross and thrust a spear into Jesus' side. A stream of blood and water flowed from his body. He was taken from the cross and placed in the arms of his grieving mother. Then the body was carried swiftly to Calvary and placed in a tomb among the rocks in Joseph's garden. On the Sunday, Mary Magdalene went to the tomb with friends to lay offerings of spices at his feet. But when they arrived there, they were shocked to see that the stone covering the entrance had been rolled away. They went inside and found Jesus' body had gone. An angel then appeared to them and said,
"Do not be afraid. You will not find him here. He has arisen from the dead. He will go forth to Galilee, and you will see him there."
Salome, who was with Mary Magdalene, said they should hurry to bring the joyful news to the disciples. And at that moment, Mary heard a voice uttering her name.
"That is his voice. Rabboni."
"Do not keep me. I have not yet gone to my Father. Go to my brothers and tell them that I am going to join my Father and your Father, my God and your God."
"He has gone. I can see him no more. But see him I did. I heard his voice. He lives, the Divine One, the merciful friend of sinners, he who makes blessed all who believe in him. If only I could proclaim it throughout the world, so that hills and mountains, heaven and earth would echo, 'Hallelujah! He has arisen!'"
"Praise be to you, the conqueror of death, who once died on Golgotha. Praise be to you, who gave your life for us. You have given us your salvation. We die to live in you."